It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning. Whoops.
Ah, that's better. Good morning.
Yes,
I'm audible now. That's good.
Yeah. Well, depending on
depending on your point of view, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah. So no Maria this week.
No Maria.
She watched the debates and she got sick, I guess.
No, she should have expected that.
Yeah, you would expect to make some sort of preparation for that. You know, I don't want to go into the gory details, right. But she'll be back with us next week though.
Very good. All right. Well, you mentioned the debates. Did you watch the debates?
I did. Had my own little private viewing party of two, and I had sort of mixed feelings, but I thought Kerry did very well, and he really needed to. He really could not afford to stumble in the way that Al Gore did 4 years ago. But the whole debate format was really, I thought, kind of unfortunate, the sort of dueling press conferences format. And they're having a town hall next week, on a week from yesterday, on Friday. And that was the format that the White House really wanted to avoid, because they don't want to have George Bush unleashed no matter what, because you could see it in the debate this week what happens when he starts going off script and starts trying to improvise comments. He just gets lost. So there's much more of a chance of that happening next week, and then there will be a third debate on domestic issues the following week on Wednesday, and that's it. You know, we have a very short attention span in this country. Can't give any more time than that to electing the most powerful person in the world for the next 4 years. The debate format was very much a reminder that the commission that organizes these events and that sets the ground rules and sets up the format is not nonpartisan. It's bipartisan, and there's a very big difference. The bipartisan format not only means that that they exclude any other parties or independent candidates, which happened once again this year, of course, but it also means that it's designed to show the candidates off in the best possible light. Now, in the case of George Bush, that's somewhat difficult to do, but they manage. I mean, I think for people who support Bush, he had a serviceable performance the other night, and for the people who support Kerry, they were very happy with Kerry. It's a debate format which makes it very easy to incorporate the sort of standard lines that are used in stump speeches, and you saw a lot of that, particularly from Bush, where when he would get off track somehow, he would just resort to parroting the same sorts of lines that he's used time and time before, and it didn't service him very well. I mean, there were some points where he looked just kind of ridiculous, like saying it's hard work. It's hard work being president. You know, it's like probably the first time he's had honest work in his life. So of course it's hard work, but when he's talking about sitting down with a mother of a soldier who was killed in combat in Iraq, and he made it sound like he was the one who was suffering because he had such anguish of sending these kids to war, as opposed to the mother of the dead soldier. I mean, it did not service him very well to be going off script like that. At the same time, we don't learn a lot from these debates. What we learn basically is that our guy won. We will hear the lines that have been tried and true on the campaign trail, and we will respond to them accordingly. And you get conflict, particularly in the case as you have this year, where you have candidates with some clear policy differences, although there were some gaping areas, and we'll talk about a couple of them later on in the show, where they were in accord. Of the issues during what was supposed to be not just a debate on Iraq, but a debate on the entire world and all of America's foreign policy. Specifically, there was nothing mentioned of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, which was in many ways even more important in terms of America's foreign policy than what's going on in Iraq, and certainly in terms of the war on terror. If you want any kind of restoration of America's credibility in the Muslim and Arab world, you've got to do something about the the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But John Kerry is very much pro-Israel, as is George Bush. And so there was really nothing to talk about, so there are no questions asked. So you have heat in the areas where there are conflict, but you don't get very much light. You don't get very much. You don't get very much in the way of an education, and that's probably going to be. We watch these events as sort of like hoping for some sort of a car wreck. You know, the gaffe or the mistake that one candidate or another will make that will let us all know that he or she is unfit to be president. And these guys are seasoned politicians. They're not going to make that kind of a mistake. But if ever one was going to happen, it would be at the town hall meeting this coming week. So it's probably worth watching.
So the town hall meeting is going to be in the format where audience members throw questions at them?
I believe so. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to do it, whether it's audience members submit the questions and then they're asked by a moderator, or audience members get to stand up and ask the question, or how they're going to do that. But the questions do come from the audience. It'll be in St. Louis next Friday night.
Yeah, one of the things that they brushed upon was Iraq, but they didn't go into any detail at all.
There was no acknowledgement for either Iraq or Afghanistan of the reality on the ground, the sorts of facts and figures that you keep hearing on this program week after week after week of exactly what's going on in Iraq. You know, what's caused the downward spiral, what will reverse the downward spiral. We didn't hear anything really from either candidate that addressed what's going to reverse the downward trend in field conditions in terms of what the soldiers are facing and what the average citizens of Iraq are putting up with from week to week. You know, from John Kerry, we heard that we're going to ask foreign governments to send their sons and daughters to go die in Iraq, which is not going to work very well. And from what we heard from George Bush is that that Iraqis want freedom and democracy, and therefore everything's going to be peaches and keen. And I'm glad that Kerry recognized in the debates and laid out for Americans to hear what they see on the evening news every night, which is that things are not going well in Iraq. But Bush is just out to left field on some of this stuff, and it's really kind of frightening because he is still the commander in chief, even for the next 2 months, let alone the possibility of the next 4 years.
Yeah. My mom, who is a devout Republican, doesn't like Kerry at all, and I think she'll vote for Bush regardless. But in talking to her the following day, she even acknowledged, she said, you know, after watching that, I think Kerry's gonna win. So
well, good
for what that's worth.
Yeah.
All right, anything else on the debate?
That's enough. They'll be with us for the next couple weeks. Yeah. So I'm sure we can talk about it more in future weeks, get Maria's take.
Yeah. All right, well, Since they didn't really go into any detail on what happened in Iraq, maybe I guess we'll go into a little more detail on that.
This week in Iraq.
Well, a lot was going on in Iraq while the presidential candidates were busy yammering in the United States. Specifically, the United States launched what has been its most extensive field operation and offensive in several months in Samarra, the city of, over the last couple of days, at least 100 killed, according to the United States military. Now that they were counting insurgents, they're not necessarily talking about women and children, but once again, some of the same sort of house-to-house urban warfare type fighting that we've seen before in Fallujah and some of the other cities in Iraq. And this is being done in preparation for the elections that are supposedly coming up in January. Now, the problem with this is that the United States has the firepower to nail down any particular piece of plot of land that it wants to in Iraq. And in fact, what has happened here is that there hasn't been that much direct fighting. The insurgents that had taken over and were effectively running Samarra for the last couple, 3 months basically just melted into the woodwork, and they'll be back another day to fight. But what happens is that the United States military has the firepower to go in and occupy any particular patch of land anytime it wants to, but it doesn't occupy the land except when it's standing four square on it. As soon as they leave, then it's back in the control of the insurgents again, and they're spread so thinly that in order to take over the land, in this case, Samarra, they have to leave somewhere else. You know, it's one of these games of, you know, you press down here and it pops up over there, or, you know, this kind of a thing. So a lot of people are probably going to die in this offensive, which is likely to go on for weeks to come. It's not particularly probably going to amount to much, because the reality is that it's going to be very, very difficult to conduct these kind of elections in anything approaching the universal ability to vote, because people, the United States can't be everywhere. The interim Iraqi government cannot be everywhere all at one time. And that's what would have to be necessary in order for these elections to come off in January. One of the greatest fears with this is the possibility that the elections will in and of themselves be cause for a civil war, because what will happen is if the elections may well go ahead without the ability of significant parts of the country to be able to cast a ballot or to have those ballots counted. And that is particularly if that goes along ethnic or religious lines, is a prescription for disaster. But it's a disaster that will happen after the election, so we're not necessarily that worried about it. At the same time, September was the bloodiest month for car bombs so far, and months also in terms of the American casualties. Ended with the worst one. 35 children were among over 50 who were killed in Baghdad on Friday with a car bombing. At least 43 different car bombings took place in September. Which is, as I say again, by far the most so far this year. And then there was also another interesting blip in the news, where the Bush administration, along with George Bush vastly overstating in the course of the debates the number of Iraqis who have actually been trained, and as we've talked about on this program, as Maria has talked about, a number of the people who have been trained then don't turn around and fight for the Americans. They then take their weapons and their training and go and fight for the insurgents, or they refuse to fight their own countrymen. But we also had an interesting admission that the Bush administration has been inflating the numbers of Iraqis who are employed in civilian jobs with the USAID. This is for reconstruction work, where the Bush administration has been saying that something like 88,000 jobs were being handed out to Iraqis. This is out of a country, remember, of 23-24 million. So it's a pretty insignificant number to begin with. But it turns out that number was inflated by nearly half. The actual number is only about 45,000. So once again, we've seen sort of a spinning of the reconstruction money, which has largely not been spent, and the reconstruction efforts to be far more extensive than they in fact have been.
Well, that's nothing new in inflating employment numbers, I guess.
Yeah, we've seen that happen domestically, so there's no reason, I guess, why that shouldn't happen in Iraq as well.
All right. Other stuff happening in Iraq?
Yeah, well, that's probably enough for this week.
All right. Well, then let's move over to the, speaking of increased military actions and activity, Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, Israel has launched a new offensive also, a story that probably should have made headlines but did not. 28 Palestinians killed on, I believe it was Friday alone, Thursday or Friday, going into a major refugee camp in the northern area, the northern part of the Gaza Strip. This is a much more densely populated area than the West Bank, where Israel has concentrated much of its military operations over the past two or three years since the second Intifada started. And again, it was done in retaliation for the mortar deaths of a couple of Israeli children. So it's one of these tit for tat things where you know, an entire population is being punished for the sins of a few. But again, I just found it remarkable that Israel and Palestine were not mentioned at all in the debates. That that the Bush administration has completely forfeited its role of trying to broker any kind of amicable solution to that problem. And there was nothing from the Kerry camp that indicates it's going to be any better under him.
Right. Well, from what I've heard from Kerry, he's pretty much backs the what the Bush administration has been doing.
Yeah,
doing in Israel.
Very much so. In both cases, Ariel Sharon has pretty much a free pass to do whatever he likes. And so far, that's just been a prescription for disaster.
All right. Moving along, the Kyoto Treaty, of course.
Yeah, that was also a piece of good news this week. Speaking again of the debates, I found it remarkable when Bush launched into his example of treaties that the United States shouldn't sign, the International Criminal Court, where this is like, you know, the United States is among the only, I believe is the only industrialized country who has not signed onto the court. And he's bragging about this as though it's something to be proud of. Well, Kyoto is pretty much at that status now also, with the Russian Duma, the parliament, having passed it, and the cabinet having passed it this week. We now have a situation where Kyoto will go into effect. It passed the threshold. It needed a threshold of, I believe it was countries representing 55% of the world's emissions to having ratified it. And because the United States has not ratified it, we represent 31% all by ourselves. It needed the extra chunk of a large country like Russia to pass it. In fact, with Russia having passed it, only the United States and Australia, among the 55 industrialized countries, now have not ratified Kyoto. So it is pretty much a global consensus at this point, leaving out the United States once again. But it will go into effect. The rest of the world is doing something about global warming, even if it's not perfect, and even if it's something the United States is moving in the opposite direction from, as we are. I mean, it's not as though we have an alternative plan other than Kyoto that we prefer instead, that we're implementing instead. We're just not doing anything at all, buying ever more SUVs.
Yeah, and it isn't like Kyoto even is asking for that much in reductions overall. It's like this minor baby step that they were trying to implement, you know, in hopes.
Yeah, it was very much designed as a first step. It took a couple of years to negotiate, and the reason it took only a couple of years to negotiate was it wasn't that dramatic a reduction. And it would have taken even less time had the United States not been so intransigent and had other countries not had taken the time that was necessary to decide to go ahead without the U.S.
All right, well, moving along, Boeing making some more news. They make news every week here in Seattle, but...
Yeah, but this was just remarkable, and I wanted to bring it up simply because I think for a lot of people here in Seattle, their eyes sort of glaze over when they see a headline with Boeing in it, and they just sort of skip over it. But this is our American justice system's work, and it involves the case of Darlene Druyan, who is the Air Force procurement officer who was at the center of a scandal when she was promised jobs for herself and her daughter and her son-in-law at Boeing after she retired from the Air Force in exchange for approving a key weapons program for the Air Force. She was prosecuted for this, and she was in court this week and filed something called an amended plea bargain, or amended plea agreement, excuse me. And in that amended plea agreement, she admitted to much more than she has before. In the past, she's just said, well, these were just technical violations, and yeah, it looks bad, but, you know, all of us use this revolving door, yada, yada, yada. Well, she comes into court and she says, well, yeah, in fact, I did steer this contract Boeing's way, and not only that, but I steered all these other contracts Boeing's way too. And we're talking about billions of dollars worth of taxpayer money improperly funded to Boeing. I mean, this is the sort of thing. This is white collar crime at its worst. We're talking, you know, it's bad, put it that way. And in exchange for this plea agreement, where she agreed to do this, what do you think she's gonna have to face in terms of a sentencing? Want to take a guess?
No, but I'm guessing it's less than what Martha Stewart will do.
I don't know what Martha Stewart's doing, so you're gonna have to fill me in for that.
Well, I don't think she's doing much either. I think she's looking at a couple of years in a posh.
Well, you're right. You're right, actually. She, Ms. Darlene is going to get 9 months in prison, another 7 months in a halfway house, and of course with reduced time for good behavior, that'll probably be about half of that. And then a $5,000 fine. This is for somebody who was making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for Boeing, and before that probably for the Air Force as well, as a very highly ranked officer. And then 150 hours of community service, which is less than a month. This is in a country where we send people to prison for life for stealing a candy bar. It really shows the difference between white-collar crime and what you might call blue-collar crime, in terms of, you know, you can steal that candy bar, that pizza, or hold up the mini mart for $20 out of the cash register and face the wrath of the state, but you can misdirect billions of dollars worth of taxpayer money and be walking the streets again in a year. It's just remarkable.
Now, does Boeing suffer any consequences of this? Because, I mean, obviously they, you know, colluded.
They don't suffer any consequences in terms of the actual criminal proceeding that's taking place. It is likely to rebound on them and on their sales when it comes to future Pentagon contracts. However, they're likely to be penalized by the Pentagon because of this scandal, and in particular, there's one contract that's up in front of Congress right now that's being contested, that was supposed to be given to Boeing, but it's probably not going to go to them now for, I believe it was 100 refueling tankers likely to be taken away from Boeing because of this scandal. But it may rebound in them in terms of other contracts in the future. Or it may not. This may be something that blows over again in a year. In terms of the actual practice of the revolving door of people in the military getting jobs at these defense contractors, and, you know, let's be fair to Boeing here, but it's not like Boeing's the only company who does this. Martin Marietta and Northrop and Grumman and Raytheon and all the others do it too. This was a particularly egregious example, but it really makes you wonder what exactly kind of standards you have to meet in order to be prosecuted for this sort of theft, and in order to have any kind of serious criminal consequences for it.
Yeah, in relation to that, I saw an article this week, in fact, I think it was actually in today's paper, that there was a study done that showed that in the last 6 years, 40% of the Pentagon contracts have been no-bid contracts. I mean, it shows, kind of demonstrates just what a transfer of funds this is to these companies.
And not only no bid, but beyond that, these companies that are supposedly competing with one another so as to save us taxpayers money in the long run, they're frequently subcontracting the work within these bids to each other. So they're often working in consortiums on some of these large, very expensive projects. And we have a Congress and we have a Pentagon that is very much addicted to these high-cost, high-tech weapon systems that the Pentagon doesn't even particularly need. It really is just a form of wealth transfer to the arms companies.
All right. Well, moving along, the ferry systems are being required to up their security.
Yeah, they're going to the dogs.
Literally.
This is something that may set up an interesting court battle. We had the news earlier this week that in order to conform to post 9/11 Coast Guard standards for maritime safety, they may resume. Well, almost certainly resume, in fact, random searches aboard Washington State ferries in the next week or so. Now, this was a program that was instituted briefly after 9/11. The ferry system tried, and the state patrols tried to start it up again in 2002, and it was stopped by a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU and I believe others. And the ACLU is looking at trying to file a lawsuit again in this case. It's very interesting because the Washington State has a constitution that is very stringent when it comes to rights to privacy, even though the federal constitution, apparently our Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights have pretty much been long ago gutted. Those rights are still pretty strong when it comes to the state. So it sets up this court case where a state's constitution is being set up against federal requirements for safety. And that's the sort of a case that that could well go, if not to the federal Supreme Court, at least all the way to the state Supreme Court, and depending on how far the litigants want to take it, it really sets up a fundamental question of who has jurisdiction and who has priority, whether it's a state's constitution or whether the federal need for quote-unquote security will trump that.
But my understanding is the motivation to do this coming from the Coast Guard at this point in time was because of the upcoming election that they were feeling like they're, you know.
And for the same reason, we had the meeting in Seattle and the other FBI field offices with all 56 around the country, with local Arab and Muslim leaders saying, sorry, guys, we're going to start putting you in jail again, just like we did after 9/11. We're going to call it detaining you, and we're going to do it for your own safety because we're worried about terrorist attacks. It really is probably more for show than anything else. I mean, your average terrorist is not going to be deterred by a couple of dogs here and there on the ferries, and it's certainly not going to be among the people who are swept up by random forays into the Muslim communities in America's cities. That's just not where the threat comes from.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish.
It goes quickly every half hour.
It does. John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State, John?
It is a volunteer, largely volunteer, I should say. We do pay our layout guy a little bit. Paper that comes out every couple of weeks, local news as well as global and comics and all that other kind of good stuff. And you can find it wherever you get free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, places like that. It's also on the web along with all the back issues at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, tips, you want to volunteer, help out in any way, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.